In this second hour of midday, we zip back 50 years to 1965. Julian Zelizer, a Princeton University historian, provides a fascinating look at how Lyndon Johnson and his Democratic allies were able to enact so much important legislation, from civil and voting rights to Medicaid, Medicare, and other building blocks of the Great Society. Meanwhile, 1965 saw an idealistic white teenager at America's High School in Georgia stand up for and remain steadfast friends with black students who were integrating the school. Years later, journalist Jim Ockmuty tells what happened after the white students' former tormentors wrote letters of apology and invited him to their 50th reunion. 1965, the big picture and a small one, next on Midday After the News. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. For some reason, we love 50th anniversary stories, possibly because we're far enough away from the events to view them with perspective, but still close enough for a lot of us to remember them. We're going to offer two views of the year 1965 in this hour of the show. We'll hear the story of a white teenager, a member of the class of 65, who was ostracized and bullied for standing with the first black students to integrate America's High School in Georgia, a hotbed of segregationist sentiment and racial hatred. But first, we'll get the big picture from Julian Zelizer, a Princeton University historian who writes about the brief period in the mid-1960s when Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson, and his allies in Congress were able to enact major civil rights legislation, create Medicare and Medicaid, begin the war on poverty, enact a racial rational immigration policy, establish new consumer and environmental protections, and make major federal investments in public transportation. Many view those years of the mid-1960s as a kind of liberal golden age, a moment after John F. Kennedy's death and the defeat of ultra-conservative Republican Barry Goldwater, when LBJ could steamroll his way through Congress. Julian Zelizer argues that in many ways, America in those days, this country was far more conservative than it is now, although conservative Republicans are still trying to dismantle Johnson's legacy today. Julian Zelizer says the legislation was enacted through hard work, both in and on Capitol Hill and in the streets of America, where blacks and whites were suddenly demanding action. Lyndon Johnson's legislation not only transformed the American social landscape, but virtually invented modern American politics. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a fellow at New America, a progressive think tank based in Washington. He's the author or editor of many books dealing with U.S. policy, leaders, and institutions since the New Deal. His latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, a phrase I love, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. It's available from Penguin Press. Julian Zelizer, thanks for taking time for us on the Midday Show here in Baltimore.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, The Fierce Urgency of Now, actually taken from a speech by Martin Luther King, correct?
Yeah, that comes from the speech in 1963 during the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, as it's known. And Martin Luther King was sending a message to the White House, which was then under President Kennedy, and to Congress, that the civil rights movement would no longer tolerate waiting for civil rights legislation on the argument that it wasn't pragmatic, that the time wasn't right, that the civil rights leaders would have to wait. And he argued there is a fierce urgency of now to certain issues like racial equality, and demanded action within days rather than within years.
To be old enough to even remember the debate over Medicare, you have to be covered by it today. In other words, you know, you got to be up there in years a bit, maybe 65 or 70 years old. So I like to ask you to set the historical context for us. What was the political landscape in Washington at the time that your narrative begins?
Yeah, this was one of the most contentious issues. Liberals had been proposing since the late 1950s that the federal government should provide hospital insurance for elderly Americans. Most elderly Americans did not really have access to good health insurance, and they couldn't afford to stay in a hospital. They couldn't afford to cover the cost of physicians. So liberals proposed that the government take this over for people who are 65 or over, and it would be paid for through the Social Security system. And the opposition to this until 1965 had been ferocious. Conservatives in Congress, Southern Democrats like Wilbur Mills, a Democrat from Arkansas who chaired the Ways and Means Committee, and Republicans prevented the bill from ever coming up for a vote until 1965. And the American Medical Association conducted a pretty brutal campaign calling Medicare socialized medicine and warning that if the government did this, it would start to take over the rest of the healthcare system and other parts of the nation. So getting this through with a program today we just consider normal was incredibly contentious and threatening to many liberals.
This is a time of activist government, and it's a time that most people believe, I think, looking back on this period, as I say, a golden age of liberalism after the death of JFK and LBJ through the power of his personality, you know, forming a coalition in Congress to get these important bills passed, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and onward into Medicaid and Medicare, building the Great Society. But you say that that's myth.
Absolutely. I mean, if we turn our attention from the White House to Capitol Hill, we see a very different political world. From the late 1930s through the mid-1960s, Congress was controlled by a conservative coalition of Southern Democratic committee chairs and their Midwestern Republican allies, who had the numbers in congressional committees and on the floor of the House and the Senate to block most legislation that they saw as liberal. And that ranged from Medicare to desegregation and voting rights to federal education policy. And they really had the power in Washington. John F. Kennedy famously died when most of his domestic agenda was totally stifled in Congress. He had almost nothing to show in terms of a legislative record. And I think just if we look at Congress, we see that the idea this was a heyday of liberalism where things naturally flowed out of Capitol Hill was false. If you read most newspaper accounts in 1963 of Congress, what people were writing about was a dysfunctional Congress where liberalism would constantly die on the vine. The first article of Life magazine after John F. Kennedy's death in December of 1963 asked the question, LBJ versus the lethargic Congress, who was going to win out?
You know, I remember listening to LBJ tape recordings of phone calls during the lobbying that went on for the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act first, and then the Voting Rights Act. And he was, you know, to my mind, my listening to those tapes on C-SPAN, very, very effective. But you say this theory of the great man who manages to get this legislation passed, this landmark legislation passed, is another myth.
It is. I mean, we have gone from criticizing Lyndon Johnson for many decades as one of the worst presidents in American history because of Vietnam, to the past few years when we have made him the ultimate example of the politician who knew how to make Congress work, who could twist arms, who could give his colleagues what was called the treatment, where he literally would hover over them physically until they voted the way he wanted them to vote, or who could almost seduce them on the phone. And all of that is true. He was a very good politician, but it doesn't really explain, you know, how Congress moved on some of these big issues. So if you look at the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the filibuster against it in the Senate during the spring of 64, Johnson's arm twisting and negotiating is very important. But what's much more important is the way the civil rights movement, its allies in Congress, its allies in Washington, and its allies at the grassroots really mobilized and organized on a sustained basis to counteract all the tricks that Southerners tried to play to kill that legislation and to keep building public pressure for a bill. Johnson didn't drop the ball when that opportunity emerged, but the story of the Civil Rights Act of 64 as an example is really much more about the movement than a presidential magician in the White House who could just get this thing through.
Why the need for the Voting Rights Act? I hope you don't mind this question, but explaining the difference between those two, one followed the other, and sometimes people get them confused, they get them mixed up, they wonder why there are two such separate acts.
Well, the Civil Rights Act didn't deal with voting. Consciously, when the bill was put together, they excluded protecting the right to vote. The bill was primarily about desegregating the South and ending segregation in public accommodations. Again, this was primarily in the South that the bill was aimed. That's the 1964 bill. The 1965 legislation is about making sure that the Justice Department guaranteed African Americans the right to vote. They had the right to vote after Reconstruction, but Southern states had put into place all kinds of mechanisms to make sure that an African American couldn't even register. And so the legislation said that's no longer tolerable when there's evidence that a state has had patterns of racial discrimination in voting, the Justice Department would proactively step in and make sure that that did not happen, proactively register African Americans. And it's a huge fight to get that bill through. This is what the protests in Selma in March of 1965 are all about. But it's an incredibly successful piece of legislation. For the years that follow its passage, African American registration will rise very dramatically, and you'll see the entrance of a whole new generation of African American politicians throughout the country, in large part as a result of this legislation.
Julian Zelizer, speaking of Selma, let's talk about the movie just for a moment, if you don't mind. I thought it was a terrific movie, but Lyndon Johnson, there's some controversy associated with it because Lyndon Johnson is pictured as equivocating, stalling on over the Voting Rights Act, despite the pleas of Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders. So your thoughts about the way he was portrayed in the film?
Yeah, I'll start by saying it's a really powerful and wonderful movie about the grassroots activism at the time, and an argument I make in the book that it really took average citizens and activists to get Washington to move forward on a lot of bills. But what it doesn't do is convey the commitment that Lyndon Johnson had developed toward the issue of voting rights by the beginning of 1965. And the movie, if you don't know the context, depicts him as a president who's more interested in surveillance on Martin Luther King, or who's more interested in other issues like Medicare and education than he is with voting rights, and really has to be pushed to see that this was important. That's just not the case. Johnson, after the election of 64, has his attorney general-to-be, Nicholas Katzenbach, drafting legislation. In February, a month before Selma, he and the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership in the Senate actually put together a bill. Johnson's not ready to send it as quickly as Martin Luther King wants, but the movie doesn't capture how committed he had become, in large part because of the movement, to the quest for voting rights. So I do think that is an unfortunate characterization of the president in a very powerful film about grassroots activism in the 60s.
Julian Zelizer is our guest, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's also a weekly columnist for CNN.com. More about 1965, his book, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And still ahead on this midday, Class of 65, the story of an idealistic white teenager at America's High School in Georgia, who stood up for and remained steadfast friends with black students who integrated that school. Please stay with us. Although many view Lyndon Johnson as the architect of the Great Society, for better or worse, Julian Zelizer argues that the legislative record Johnson and his allies amassed in 1965 and 1966 changed the political landscape of this country. And despite fierce counterattacks from conservatives in recent years, LBJ succeeded in changing the starting point for American political discourse. We'll talk more about that in this segment of the show as we return to our conversation with Julian Zelizer. His book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. So I just have to take a moment here and we have to reflect on something. It's hard to imagine any of this legislation passing today with the current Congress. And for a lot of people, it's hard to imagine a man like Lyndon Johnson from Texas having these views and being passionate about them. So, I mean, I guess there are moments, Julian Zelizer, when you must think the same things. Like, this is kind of remarkable. I know it's 50 years ago and the landscape has changed. Politics have changed, but it's still pretty remarkable what LBJ did.
Absolutely. I mean, what LBJ and many liberal Democrats of that period had, who had entered into Congress since the 50s, was a basic, fundamental commitment to using government to deal with social and economic issues. And many of them, including Johnson, were products of the New Deal. These had been the formative years for someone like LBJ. They revered Franklin Roosevelt. They revered what the Democratic Congress of the 1930s had done. And they did have a belief, even though it was hard to get these bills through, that ultimately the federal government had an important role in dealing with these issues. And that was a commitment that was very powerful at the time.
We started off talking a little bit about Medicare because I noticed that I noted that anybody who's listening today who remembers the debate is probably on Medicare today. But as you noted, the American Medical Association had lobbied against health care for the elderly for a couple of decades. And Medicare, this idea, was never able to gain much traction until Johnson was president. So why did it suddenly have the votes to pass in, I guess, 65 or 66?
Well, in some ways, it's in 65. It's more about Barry Goldwater than Lyndon Johnson, I argue in the book. I mean, Johnson tries to get Medicare through in 64. And once again, even after Kennedy's death and even after all the good feeling about that president, the bill gets nowhere. Wilbur Mills, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, won't even let it come out for a vote. But in 1964, in the election, Johnson devastates Barry Goldwater. Goldwater was a Republican from Arizona. He ran as a right-wing Republican. And one of the issues he was criticized for was his opposition to Medicare. So after the election of 1964, there are no Republicans who want to look like Barry Goldwater. For the time being, they think they have to do something about some of these social issues. And more important, the election of 64 creates these huge liberal Democratic majorities in Congress, 295 Democrats in the House, 68 Democrats in the Senate, and the balance between the Southerners and the liberal Northerners shifted to the liberals. So Wilbur Mills, to come back to him, realizes the game is over. And as soon as that election is done, he sees that Republicans and Democrats are going to vote around him for legislation for Medicare if he says no. And so he joins in and actually becomes an architect of the program. So really what happens is that election and this Republican who decides to run what was a far-right campaign that included attacks on this idea of health care for the aged.
The aged, the elderly, you know, a lot of those people vote. Much is made about the fact that, you know, people over 60, 65 are among the most loyal voters, the people who vote regularly in off-year elections and presidential elections. So didn't they care about that?
They do care about that. But, you know, Medicare was still an idea. Social Security was not as entrenched as a program as it is today. And so, you know, the elderly were still not this voting bloc that could not be ignored because they were ignored. And the American Medical Association was really firmly against this idea, against this proposal, because they believed it would allow for too much government control of medicine. So the idea that providing benefits to the elderly was always the politically right thing to do was not the case when this program was fought for. The real driver behind this was also organized labor. The AFL-CIO is a huge political force at this time, and they mobilize and try to counteract what the AMA was doing.
And then there's Medicaid, and it would seem on its face to be far more controversial, yet they were able to get this passed too. So once again, a little bit of a history on Medicaid versus Medicare for our listeners.
Yes, it's a funny story. By February of 1965, after that election, not only do you have this administration plan for hospital insurance for the elderly, but Republicans start to offer their own health care plans. One is to cover the cost of physicians, and the other is to a smaller program, which was basically health care welfare, health care for the poorest elderly Americans, not for all Americans. And you had these three ideas on the table, and Wilbur Mills, who a year earlier had been the opponent of these programs, says, to the surprise of everyone in the room, let's do all of them at once. Let's put them together in a bigger bill, a three-layer cake. And that's Medicare A, hospital insurance, Medicare B, physicians insurance, and Medicare, and Part C, which is Medicaid. At the time, no one thought much of the Medicaid program. It was very small, very minor, and no one imagined that it would actually become one of our biggest government programs over the next few decades.
LBJ was elected in 64, soundly defeated Goldwater. He comes in the office in 65. So this is his first year and a half. Yep. He's got to get all this done. This is sort of the way presidents function, right? The same was true of Roosevelt.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really learned about Lyndon Johnson was that he, more than anyone else, understood the limits of presidential power. He was not someone who thought the president can do whatever he wanted, and he was certainly a person who thought conservatives were much stronger in America than most liberals understood. So after the election, he is determined, he talks about this all the time, to move as fast as possible because he anticipates that he has about a year and a half to get things done, and that conservatives would regain their power, and slowly he wouldn't be able to do much once Congress turned against him. So as a product of Congress, as someone who had been in Congress since the late 1930s, he fully understood how much his success depended on Capitol Hill being in his favor. And so he tried to move as fast as possible in that first year. He tells members of his cabinet they have to return every call from a member of Congress within minutes. And he also tells them that they have to push for everything, because after the midterms of 66, he won't be able to get anything done.
Two terms that keep showing up in your book, of course, the War on Poverty and the Great Society. LBJ used those terms. Did they resonate with people at the time? Was there polling? Could you tell at the time in 1965 how average Americans felt about these ideas of the government taking these actions?
They're pretty popular. I mean, a lot of the war on poverty is the most controversial. You know, initially there's enthusiasm for it when it passes in 64. It's actually a pretty small program at first, doesn't have much of a budget. Not many Americans are aware of what it's going to do. And that becomes much more controversial than the Great Society within about a year or two, because in the cities it starts to get connected in the minds of conservatives to radical politics. The Great Society, which is really the umbrella term for everything, including programs like Medicare, is pretty popular for a while. And, you know, there are many Americans in the polls who register favorable approval ratings for what the government is doing on health care, on education, and even to some extent in the North, certainly on civil rights. So the Great Society is a problem for conservatives after it starts to pass, because they realize a lot of Americans like these benefits.
Julian Zelizer is our guest in this hour of midday. The fierce urgency of now, a phrase taken from Martin Luther King, one of his speeches, perhaps his most famous speech. The title of Julian Zelizer's book, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society, is the subtitle. So I want to talk a little bit about where we are today and looking back on some 50 years to the declared war on poverty. You know, income inequality in this country is greater than it was in the 1890s. And studies show that the chances of escaping a life born into poverty seem even lower. We've had a comprehensive 30-year study by a Johns Hopkins professor that pretty much concluded that in looking at some 800 children in Baltimore City over that period. So, you know, the idea of the war on poverty it has been criticized a great deal. Looking back on it 50 years, people say it's a failure. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that kind of argument misses what the Great Society programs did. I think that's the perfect way to think about what was going on relative to the growing inequality we had today. Simply in terms of poverty, most of the best studies we have of the impact of programs like the Economic Opportunity Act or food stamps or Head Start show that, in the first 10, 15 years of this program, before we have the Reagan administration and the effort to really start cutting some of these benefits, it actually alleviates conditions of poverty. It doesn't get rid of them. It's not a war where you eradicate the enemy, but poverty falls. And the programs are credited with part of that success. And the second success is that they provide all kinds of pillars of support. If you look at all the programs from this period, from Medicaid to food stamps to the actual War on Poverty programs, that remain very important today. Without those programs, conditions of poverty would be much worse. So I think when the blame goes to the Great Society, it's misguided. I think there are many other forces that are producing the kind of inequality we see today, from changes in the economy, jobs moving out of the country, to changes in public policy. We've seen a really conservative turn in tax policy, for example, and in funding for the inner cities. And that all explains, in my mind, why the inequality is becoming much worse than somehow making this case that it was the Great Society itself which is to blame for the failure.
Very interesting. You still hear politicians debating virtually every part of the Great Society and Republicans trying to repeal aspects of it. And they've had many opportunities to do that over the years, over these 50 years. But it's still there. Most of the pieces are still there. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that. What does that tell us about the nature of the way things change in this country?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing. My book is really about just how quickly all this happens. Most of the Great Society passes in about a year and a half to 2 years. That's it. After the 1966 midterms, the attention of Congress turns to cutting the budget, to the war in Vietnam, and there's not a lot of other big programs that come out of that period. So it's a brief window. But during that window, it's not only that there's a lot of legislation that passes, it's legislation that survives to this day. It has survived through the age of Reagan, through this conservative era of politics. And today, even when America has shifted further to the right, we live in the shadow of the Great Society. Most of these programs are in place. And most of these programs are very popular. So I have in the book, I talk about when Obama's pushing for the Affordable Care Act, and many people will remember Tea Party Republicans held up signs, "Get your government hands off my Medicare," because of proposed cuts.
Yeah.
And it was funny and ironic, but it also reflects how these became ingrained in American society and I think are still hard to retrench.
Speaking of President Obama, I just want to ask you this before we leave you today, Julian Zelizer. And a lot of people say Barack Obama was handed the same kind of opportunities Lyndon Johnson was when he was elected. So Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that's his primary legacy. As some people would say, well, that's about it. There isn't much more there. I wonder if you would reflect on President Obama for us a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, he did get a lot done in that first year, and we have the health care program. We had the stimulus, which is a really big program that I think we don't take into account in the recovery. And we had financial regulation and some environmental regulation. So in the first year, when he had a Congress that was favorable to him, he didn't achieve another Great Society, but he did achieve some pretty significant bills. Again, it showed how important Congress is to presidential success. Since 2010, it doesn't matter if he would have been more like President Johnson. It wouldn't matter if Obama schmoozed a little more or played more golf with Speaker Boehner. The reality is he has a Congress that was just stacked against him, where conservatives had immense power on the Hill and were not willing to cooperate with him. And so I think Obama did all right in the time span that he had, but he faces political conditions that have been far worse than, in some ways, what Lyndon Johnson was able to achieve. And he has no civil rights movement behind him. He has no union movement behind him. He lacks some of the weapons that Johnson could ultimately rely on during that brief period.
Julian Zelizer, I've enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public policy at Princeton and student of America's political and social upheaval since the New Deal. The book that we've been talking about, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society, published by Penguin, focusing on the year 1965. That is our focus. Coming up, the story of the one white student who stood up for his black classmates at a newly integrated high school in 1965. And welcome back to Midday. So far, we've been talking about the big picture of 1965, when the push got underway for the signature bills of the Civil Rights era, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, but neither was ever a sure thing. And for ordinary people caught in the crossfire in the segregationist South, life could be nasty, difficult, and dangerous. An unlikely soldier in the battle over civil rights was a teenager named Greg Whitcamper, who was raised on a little-known interracial commune near Americus, Georgia. Americus was a bastion of segregation. And when four black students, Greg knew, volunteered to integrate the town's all-white high school, Greg stood up for them, while the rest of his classmates, all white, insulted, assaulted, and bullied them, all of them, in an outpouring of racial hatred. Although he was white, Greg was bullied, harassed, and even beaten himself, but maintained the principles of nonviolence he'd learned on the commune. That's the story Jim Ockmuty tells in a sad and disturbing but ultimately uplifting new book called The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and the Long Road to Forgiveness. Jim Ockmuty spent almost three decades as a reporter and editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and twice won the Cox newspaper chain's Writer of the Year Award. We're happy to get him on the show today to talk about his book. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
How did you first come across the story of Greg Whitcamper?
Well, the place that he grew up was this Christian commune called Koinonia. It's a Greek word that means fellowship. And actually, right after I started at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, I learned about Koinonia, and it was the first out-of-town assignment I ever took, going down to Americus to visit the farm and write about it. This was 10 or 15 years after they had been boycotted and treated with a lot of violence down there. Koinonia was very controversial in Georgia. It was founded in the 1940s, and they believed in racial justice, interracial living, pacifism, and communal living, which in the eyes of the locals made them race mixers and communists, which were two of the worst things that you could be in Georgia in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And the root of the problem for Greg and the other children from this farm is when they went into the public schools, they were known to come from this notorious place. And this place had defended the civil rights workers who were coming into Southwest Georgia in the early 60s. They had staged orientation sessions for people from SNCC and SCLC and some of these civil rights organizations. So everybody in the local schools, all the white kids, knew that this was an enemy camp, and anyone who came from this community was the enemy.
Greg Whitcamper, could you talk about his parents a little bit? What were they like?
Greg's father was a Disciples of Christ minister from Indiana who believed in nonviolence, and he had a series of churches in the late 40s, or in the 1940s, and he always got kicked out of the churches because he would advise the young men not to register for the draft, which was very unpopular advice back in those days. And he heard about this community in Georgia, and he thought that they would be kindred spirits. And they moved there in 1953, about the same time that Jimmy Carter's family, that he left the Navy and returned home because his father had died. His mother was a Methodist missionary, so he came from church folks on both sides of the family.
Okay, so Greg Whitcamper is going to America's High School, and America's High School is about to be integrated, and he knows the students who are going to integrate the school. At least he knows some of them, right?
He knows them all.
He knows them all.
When Greg was growing up at Koinonia, Koinonia was bombed, Greg, they were drive-by shootings at the farm. When he was 7 or 8 years old, he was out playing volleyball one night when he got shot at by the Klan. So he had been through this stuff for years. And then in the early 60s, the mass demonstrations started in southwest Georgia, where there was the Albany movement, where there were people getting arrested on a scale never seen before in a southern city, and they were being farmed out to all these jails in the little towns around there. And then those demonstrations inevitably came to Americus, which is a pretty good size town in southwest Georgia. And Gregg took part in a lot of those demonstrations. The people at Koinonia were allies of the movement. So he knew the black children. He knew the black kids who were going to be desegregating the high school.
Okay. So, and the school board had decided to enroll these students in this school, and so this was going to happen. And there came a time when someone actually drove the black students to America's High School, right?
At the beginning of the school year in the fall of 1964, there were four black students who were desegregating the high school, and Gregg wanted to show his support for them. So he drove, he rode in the black funeral home limousine that was carrying three of them to school that day. And they were greeted by a scene out of Little Rock. There was a mob there throwing rocks and bottles and screaming racial hatred at them. And the limousine pulls up in front of the school, and the sheriff opens the door, and the first person to pop out wasn't one of these black students. It was this white kid from Koinonia, Gregg. And he had always been mistreated in school, but from that moment forward, he was considered a real traitor to his race, and he was particularly marked for punishment. And he also happened to be the only kid from Koinonia at the high school that fall. So all the anger that his white classmates were feeling about the way things were changing, about the new civil rights law and all the civil rights changes, all that anger came down on him and the black students, but particularly on him because he was considered a traitor.
Yeah, you said he was punished all through the school year. In what ways was he punished, Jim? What did Gregg tell you about that?
Well, he was actually assaulted a couple of times. He was hit once in the jaw so hard that he was sore for over a month. There was a lot of low-grade stuff. They urinated in his locker. They trashed his books. They kicked him when he came by. They hit him with paper clips. He was hit with spitballs. He was called all sorts of names. There was one scene where, one guy hit him with a sloppy Joe in the cafeteria one day. It just hit him in the face. There was one scene where somebody accused him of calling him a dirty name and said he wanted to see him after class, after school and have a fight. And Gregg didn't think much of it because he had heard so many threats all the time he was at that high school. Well, on this day, the threat was real. When he was leaving the school, there were 40 or 50 boys waiting for him beside the baseball grandstand, and they all came out and surrounded him. And it's actually kind of one of the key scenes of the book because one of them hauled off and hit him in the face, and Gregg refused to fight back. He actually gave brief consideration to tangling with this guy, but what he did was a scene right out of the New Testament. He jutted out his jaw and kind of turned the other cheek, sat there and waited for him to hit him again, and he told this guy who hit him, his name was Thomas, he said, "I love you, Thomas."
Wow.
And that sort of disarmed him. Nobody knew what to do with a guy who had just been hit that hard and wouldn't fight back.
So Gregg Whitcamper stuck to his principles of nonviolence and also the principles of racial brotherhood. It sounds like his only friends in the school were the black students.
They were the only friends. There was one white student who, as the year went on, became increasingly uncomfortable with the way this guy was being persecuted and bullied. And he actually said something in a couple of the classes about how, I don't agree with what Gregg stands for, but I don't think we should be doing this stuff to him. It's just not Christian. And actually, in June of 1965, when the class of 65 graduated, at the graduation ceremony, Gregg's name was booed, and a black friend he had come with were chased away from the gymnasium by about 15 or 20 men throwing things at him, calling him names. But before the ceremony started, this one classmate who had started having misgivings about it walked up to Gregg and shook his hand and said, "I don't know how you made it." And this guy, Gregg says it was by far the nicest gesture that any white student had made to him in his entire time in high school. And Greg took it as a very hopeful sign that minds were just beginning to start changing.
40 years later, we jump ahead, Jim Ockmuty, for this part of the story, because we only have so much time together today.
Mm-hmm.
A letter comes to Jim Ockmuty, who's by then a grown man living in West Virginia, and he's invited to his class reunion.
The man who shook Greg's hand at graduation was a man named David Morgan. He's now a banker in Middle Georgia. And David, as happenstance would have it, was the person in charge of planning their 40th reunion. And he started thinking about it, and he asked several of the other students if they had ever regretted what happened to Greg and all of the ugliness that unfolded back then. And a lot of them had. A lot of them really felt bad about it. And David and a couple of the other students orchestrated this letter-writing campaign, really. Greg had been living in West Virginia since the mid-70s. He goes to get his mail one day in the spring of 2006. He finds an invitation to his high school reunion, which he's never gotten before. That totally floors him. And then he finds this letter from David Morgan, his old classmate. Do I have a minute to read just a second of it?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Okay. He says, "Dear Greg, I expect you will be quite surprised to hear from me. If you remember me at all, it will likely be for unpleasant reasons. I was a classmate of yours at America's High School and graduated with you in 1965. I don't recall ever directly assaulting you, but I probably did to gain the acceptance and accolades of my peers. In any case, I surely participated as part of an enabling audience and tacitly supported and encouraged those who did. For that, I am deeply sorry and regretful. Through the last 40-plus years, I have occasionally thought of you and those dark days you endured at our hands. As I matured, I became more and more ashamed and wished that I had taken a different stand back then. I knew even then that it was all wrong, yet I did nothing to stop it or even to discourage it."
Wow.
And the letter goes on for quite a while. It's a really beautiful and eloquent letter.
Wow.
And it wasn't the only letter. There were about 10 of his classmates who wrote similar letters to Greg that all arrived within 3 or 4 days of each other in West Virginia, asking for his forgiveness, telling him that they had changed, and asking him to come back to their reunion.
Now, what about the black students that Greg entered the school with that fall of 64 and graduated with in 65? What about his connection to them over the years?
Well, Greg moved away from America's, and he went off to college and had a very interesting experience where he traveled around the world with this Quaker college called Friends World. And then he settled in West Virginia, and he didn't really stay in touch with much of anybody in America's except for his parents, who continued to live at the commune. Only one of those four black students stuck it out at the high school and graduated. The rest of them all transferred to other places because the schoolwork was harder than what they were accustomed to, and most importantly, because they were being harassed. And when Greg got these letters, one of the first things he wondered was, you know, I wonder if any of my black friends down there who went through the same sorts of things I went through, if they've ever been afforded the same offer of forgiveness and reconciliation. And the short answer is, for the most part, no.
So they never received letters like the one Greg received from Dave Morgan?
No, they never have. There have been a couple of individual instances of people reaching out to some of the black students and some very nice gestures and a couple of moving things that I deal with in the epilogue. But for the most part, they just have not been given the same sort of reconciliation that Greg was given here. Now, I should add that there was not a black member of the class of 65. All of the blacks who entered the school in 65 were underclassmen. So there wasn't anybody that would have been invited back to this particular reunion. But for the most part, they haven't been invited back to the reunions of their classes.
Okay, well, thank you for clearing that up. So they were younger than Greg and his classmates.
Greg, yeah.
Okay, thank you for clearing that up, Jim.
Robertina Freeman, who was the one who stuck it out, she was class of 67, as I recall.
Okay.
So she would have been a 10th grader when Greg was a graduating senior.
Did Greg go to his class reunion?
Greg did go to the reunion, and he found... He found, you know, the first act of the reunion was a luncheon they had at an English teacher's house, an English teacher who had been sympathetic to Greg in high school and who knew what he was going through, and who knew that there were other students who were sympathetic to Greg but didn't dare show it because of the tenor of the times, and they thought they would be punished if they showed any sympathy toward him. They had a small luncheon at her house with David Morgan and Greg and a handful of other students who had reached out to him. That was very emotional and fulfilling for him. The larger reunion itself was almost a little anticlimactic. People were friendly to him there. Most of the people were supportive of what was happening. There were definitely some people who still thought that much ado was being made about nothing and just probably would have been happy if Greg hadn't shown up. They didn't want to revisit that. Some of those people thought that what Greg had gone through, all that was being exaggerated. Some of them hadn't really changed that much in their own attitudes. Some of them didn't like these ugly old embarrassing stories intruding on their reunion weekend. But most of them were pretty supportive. And, you know, for Greg, it was a healing experience, but you know what? I think it was more of a healing experience for the people who were reaching out to him.
Yeah.
They're the ones who actually had to make things right. Greg had made peace with it years before.
He had. I was going to ask you that because you noted in the book that he felt scarred for life and that at one point even contemplated suicide.
Well, Greg had felt suicidal at one point when he was in high school, and he had some bad nightmares in the years right after he got out of high school. But for the most part, it's remarkable of how much he had moved on from it and didn't have any rancor over it. Yeah, he still had some psychological damage from it, and he still would tear up when he would talk about it. I mean, in the times I've interviewed him numerous times over the last few years, it doesn't take much to get him to start crying about all this, just talking about it. But he had pretty much forgiven them. His attitude always was that if our cribs had been switched at birth, they probably would believe what I believed, and I probably would believe what they believed.
Hmm.
They were reflecting the attitudes of their parents, is what he believes.
Hey, Jim Akmuti, I'm just curious, what is America's like today, America's Georgia, in terms of the racial divide or not, lack of divide, integration, and what is the high school like?
Well, America's is a really charming old cotton and peanut town, and it's got an awful lot of history in it. That Koinonia was the birthplace of Habitat for Humanity, and there's a large operation of Habitat down there. There's all the Jimmy Carter stuff. On the northern end of the county, there's the Andersonville prison camp. So, you know, and you've got Koinonia, so there's just a really oversized slab of southern history down there. The town itself is about 50-50 white and black. The high school, America's High School, now is over 90% black. Most of the white students left and went to a private school, and it is overwhelmingly white. It has a very small minority component in it. But you know what? Every time I'm tempted to feel a little bit smug about that or superior because of what happened with the schools down there, I look at the suburban school I went to in Atlanta, and the same things happen there. It's just that we use different phraseology to describe it. It's the resegregation of the school down there after a brief period of true integration. It's not something that's particular to the rural South or even to the South. It's American.
Jim Akmuti has been our guest in this segment of the show, talking about this remarkable story. The Class of 65 is the name of his book. It started off as a feature story for the newspaper he was working for, and now it's a book, The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and the Long Road to Forgiveness. Jim, thank you very much for being with us on the show today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Basic Books is the publisher of The Class of 65. Ladies and gentlemen, our listeners in the audience, I hope you enjoyed our journey from 1995 back to 1965, our two-hour show looking at two pivotal years in American history. Hope you enjoyed today's program, and we'll come back tomorrow for more Midday. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR. your NPR news station.